Okay, so let's start out with some logistical notes. So if you didn't notice, we, as of less than an hour ago, but apparently people figure out fast, I released exam grades. Average was something like an 83 after the rubric. Okay. And a note on the rotate assignment. So hopefully most of you have looked at it. So I unfortunately probably set the threshold too low compared to for what we wanted you to actually do. I didn't realize this because our test suite was for previous semester setup, which had slightly different sizes and a different architecture to run on. So it didn't show me that, oh, this is maybe a little too easy to get to. So it's too late to change, but if you want to learn what we like want you to know for the final and things like that, I would suggest aiming for at least a little higher, 1.65, 1.77, which means that you definitely won't be using a strategy which we don't want to be enough to do it. And smooth, I would note, is more work than rotate. This has been true in past semesters. It's probably still true. So don't assume you're going to do as little work on smooth as on rotate. It's not what's going to happen. Okay. So last time we were talking about a little about loop optimizations. And we used our idea that of loop unrolling, that we had this problem that in a loop we have most of our operations are just loop overhead if we have very little work. So in a loop like this where we have one instruction worth of actual work, we have four instructions of overhead to just make the loop work, to keep track of the index of the loop and to keep track of whether or not we need to keep going in the loop. And sort of a basic idea that we can use to make this loop into something faster is that we can say, well, I'm going to do more work for each time I need to do that loop overhead. So each time I increment I and do the comparison to see if I'm done, let's do two things of work rather than one. And this seems like it should be obviously better, because even though this code is longer, we're doing more work per iteration. We should be running less instructions. In this case, a lot less instructions. And that presumably takes over. And I had to be a little clever to do this. So I turned this increment into an add to. But I didn't have to be that clever to actually get some advantage. So I'd still be faster if I had an increment after this first add and didn't figure out how to change the add instruction. Because I'd still not be running the compare instruction over and over again and the jump less than equal instruction over and over again. It also means that this transformation is fairly mechanical. And it seems like something your compiler could do. So what might stop our compiler from doing this? Why would our compiler not want to just automatically do this transformation every time? Something like it. So yeah.
Well, it doesn't know like maybe whether or not or how many like times it might have to iterate. So like you might have the whole issue of leftovers and having to deal with the leftovers.
Yeah. So one issue is that we have leftover, and so the compiler would need to generate this code to handle the leftovers. So that in itself isn't a problem, but it means that our code isn't getting one instruction longer. It's actually getting a whole bunch of instructions longer because we have the comparative test if we have leftovers, and then the work for the leftovers. And this gets a bit more serious when we are unrolling more than twice. So that's part of it. So it doesn't know about the leftovers. Is it always going to be faster to unroll loops? So it is true that that assuming that our leftover cases aren't bad, which could happen, that we're going to run less instructions. So most of the time, you run less instructions when you unroll loops. Does that mean they're faster? So it would be an example of a reason why they may not be faster. Yeah. You have, no? OK.
It would just end up rolling like more memory accesses maybe, or just slower.
OK. Okay, so we have to access memory more times when we have more instructions. So in particular, we can think about this with our instruction cache. So our instruction cache is usually pretty big, like several kilobytes. Usually we don't think of our functions as being much bigger than that. But loop unrolling is certainly a way to start getting there. So if we unroll all the time, then maybe we're going to end up with more cases where we run out of space in the instruction cache, we start accessing memory more often, and our program becomes slower, even though we're running less instructions. So are there other, well, I guess that's the main issue, so, is that that could happen. So it's not necessarily a gain to do loop unroll. So, you see the pattern here. So our basic pattern for loop unrolling when we're doing it by hand is I just repeat the thing of the loop, repeat each iteration of the loop. This is one way of doing it. Here I'm doing I plus equals 4 and handling each possible I manually, replacing I with I plus 1. I could also, for example, just do I plus plus and insert an I plus plus after each plus equals and not have I plus 1, I plus 2, I plus 3, I plus 4. All work. It's the same idea. We're still getting rid of the redundant comparisons for are we done with this loop yet? So automatic loop unrolling is something that compilers can and do, but they're conservative about it. You know, they don't want to make your code slower with their optimizations. And if they did too much loop unrolling, they'd make your code slower in cases where you had a loop that was executed a lot, but each time with only a small number of iterations because of that leftover handling. And if they did a lot, they'd make your code very large. So if you have lots of loops in code, which probably most of them aren't executed very much, but if we unroll all of them, we might like double or triple the size of your code. That's going to make it very likely that you'll run out of instruction cache space, that you'll start paying for those memory accesses. And it's not going to be worth the savings of not doing as many comparisons. So compilers are going to be conservative because they don't want you to turn on the optimization flag and your program gets slower. So they're going to do things they're pretty sure will work, not things which are often get into problems. And note that in particular, they don't know which loops in your program have a large or small number of iterations, unless they can like statically determine that the thing bounding the number of iterations is a large number. But often they can't do that, often that's a variable. There's no way the compiler can know that this loop is likely to benefit from unrolling or not. So it will do unrolling, but it will use some heuristics to say, well, unrolling is a pretty good idea. So an example of a heuristic is, if the loop is really small, then the penalty for unrolling it when you shouldn't have is pretty small. But the benefit is really high if that loop is executed a lot. So that's a good loop to automatically unroll. But you, as a programmer, know more about what loops are important. You are more willing to see if you make your code larger, if that's a problem. So you're probably going to be able to do better by exploring when you can unroll loops than your compiler will by just being conservative about it and trying not to surprise you by making your code slower. So when we do loop unrolling, so this is for the sum example. So I unrolled the loop 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32 times and carefully made sure my compiler wasn't doing any additional unrolling. And these are the performance results I got. So I'm showing you this number of clock cycles it takes per element, per thing I needed to add to the sum, and the number of instructions I executed per element. So we have 1.3, 1.03, and basically, you know, we get to 1.01, and that's where we stop getting more efficiency. And this is not because we weren't still getting a bigger benefit in the number of instructions. So we have this mismatch here, and this is pretty common, where I'm getting down to a limit for the number of cycles per element I take, even though I'm executing less instructions. Often a lot less, like half as many. So why is this happening? Why didn't I get the full benefit I could have gotten? So what could be causing me to be limited at this one cycle per element? So this is a tricky question, and it's tricky because this is not something which would happen on the processor we made. On the processor we made, these timings are not possible for a lot of reasons. But on the processor we made, executing more instructions always takes at least one cycle extra. So part of the reason this is happening is because I'm running this on a modern processor, which is one of those out-of-order superscalar processors we talked about. So for thinking about why this is happening, where you should start is you should remember that what that processor does is it takes a piece of your program and treats it as a data flow program. So you should think, how does this look like as one of those sort of data flow diagrams that Samira showed you? And how would this be executed? Yeah?
So since so many instructions are being run simultaneously, doesn't that mean that in the end, the only limiting factor is really the latency of the longest instruction and also the register delay?
Yeah, so the biggest factor here is therefore the latency. So we can run lots of things at the same time, but what matters is how long the longest chain of things we have to run is. And that's what this constraint is. So our one cycle per element is because of the latency of our additions. And we can picture this more clearly by sort of drawing out what the data flow diagram would look like. So you don't think about it when you think of the loop. You think of the loop as being a bunch of adds, but that's not what it is, because we also have to load values from the array to do the summing. So this is our data flow diagram of the loop. We have part of it, this, where we're computing the address to load from the array. I'm doing this in a simpler way maybe than maybe it's actually happening, just to make this diagram readable. And once we compute an address, after that we can load it. And after we load something, then we can add it to the sum. And here we're actually doing a bunch of things at the same time. So even though we think of one cycle per element, that means I'm doing one add per cycle. That's perfect. That's one instruction per cycle. It's not one instruction per cycle because we have these extra operations to do. So basically, when I'm getting that one cycle per element, I'm doing three operations per cycle. I'm computing an address, I'm loading an address, a different address, and I'm adding a value that I already loaded. So I'm doing things in parallel. But this is the most I can do, because after I do these operations, I need to wait for them to finish. I don't have any more things I can do at the same time. In particular, I'm limited by what our book calls the critical path. So in order to compute the sum, I need to load the first element of the array and wait for that to finish. Then I need to compute the sum of the first two numbers, and the sum of the sum and the second number, and the third number, and the fourth number, and I need to wait for each one of those things to finish, one after the other. And so the performance we're getting is because on my desktop, it happens that doing an add has a one cycle latency. However, it turns out that this is not actually the maximum performance of my desktop. So here we're getting one cycle per add, and we're doing actually two adds per cycle, one for the address, one for the actual computation of the sum, but my desktop can do four. But we aren't actually getting that performance because we're waiting. We need to wait for each one to complete to start the next set of two adds. So we're only getting two per cycle. So any questions about why we're limited to one cycle per addition here, even though our processor can do multiple adds per cycle? Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes, it's because this add needs to wait for the previous one. This add needs to wait for the previous one to finish. So yeah, that's the big limitation. So our book has a solution for this, which they call multiple accumulators. And the idea is that we're going to split up this computation, and we're going to compute two sums. We're going to compute, say, the sum of the odd elements and the sum of the even elements. And then we're going to add those together. And that gives us a different sort of data flow diagram. So we have computing the sum of the odd and the even. And when we're running this fully, we're doing six operations per time, at most, at least. and including two useful ats. And our performance is going to be limited by the critical path again. But the critical path here, it goes from one of these A addresses all the way to the final sum. So our critical path, for not being much longer, we're doing basically twice as much work. Because we can now do two useful sums in parallel, which is what we need to do to take advantage of the fact that my processor can add four things at a time. And so this is a fairly simple transformation of our unrolled loop code, in that I have, instead of a sum variable, I have a sum1 and a sum2. Add those together, and at the end, I add the two sums together. So does this transformation make sense? Any questions? Yeah?
Does your processor have,
Yeah, so the question is, does this mean my processor has four ALUs? Basically, yes. It's a little more complicated than that. So not all the ALUs can do all operations. So like there's only one ALU which can do divisions, for example. Okay. So, and we can do this with more than sum1 and sum2, and we can mix this with normal loop unrolling. So here, I unrolled the loop twice and had two accumulators. I could have unrolled the loop eight times and had two accumulators. I could have done sum1 equals ai plus 2 and so on, make change that to 4, something like that. So I can mix and match this with loop unrolling. This is something we do after loop unrolling. This is one of the advantages of loop unrolling in general, is that in addition to making the loop faster itself, it might expose more optimizations we can do. This is also true for other optimizations we might not talk about that, you know, might be exposed to the compiler by doing loop unrolling. Because, for example, you might make it more obvious that two accesses to an array are two things which can't alias each other, because there's no loop in between to make that uncertain. So if I actually try this out, here's the performance I get. So I took my 16x unrolled loop, so I could test up the 16 accumulators, and I tried all the various numbers of accumulators, 1, 2, 4, 8, and 16. And you can see that I'm not spending substantially more instructions for the first few, at least. And I go around from my one cycle per element to 0.57, then 0.57, and then things start getting worse. And also, I'm even spending more instructions. Like a lot more instructions at 16. A few more I expect, because I have to do the sum at the end. That's a few more instructions. But I have a lot more with 16. So why does this not keep helping me? Or at least not hurt me? Yeah?
Are you just adding too much overhead?
So what type of overhead? So
overhead is like, I don't know, the number of like, I mean, you're keeping track of 16 different sums, right?
So that yeah. So one thing to think about is that in this 16 accumulator version, I need to keep track of 16 sums. So how are we going to do that? When the compiler generates the assembly, where are those 16 sums going to go?
In a whole 16 registers.
Yeah.
It has to go on the stack, right? Because you only have so many registers.
Yeah, so we have 16 registers, but one of them is the stack pointer. Probably we want one of them for one of the address of the array. So we definitely don't have actually 16 registers to keep sums in. And you can see this if you look at the assembly the compiler generates for that. It generates assembly where it gets the appropriate element of A, then adds it to something on the stack. And this is called register spilling. So the compiler is actually really good at, given its local variables and maybe non-local variables that it knows don't alias pointers, or pointer accesses it knows don't alias things, it's really good at putting them in registers as well as it can. But if it runs out of registers, it's going to use the stack. And it's not going to tell you it's doing it, it's just going to do it. And this is a reason why you might try to do an optimization in one of our performance assignments that, say, adds lots of local variables, and suddenly find your code is a ton slower. This is one of the reasons that can happen. It's not the only one, but it's a very common one. And it's because we added a whole bunch of loads and stores. Yeah, they're going to be cached, but there's still extra loads and stores. The normal code we want the compiler to generate, when it really figures this out, is going to be something like this. Yeah?
So is there like a hard limit to the number of like local variables we try to stick to?
So the question is, given that I know about register spilling, how many local variables should I use? So your rule of thumb is on 64 and x86, there are 16 registers. And like at least one of them the compiler needs for the stack pointer. And you probably need to assume that you need a few more registers for temporary values. So the rule of thumb is probably that given that there's 16, you want a bit less than 16 local variables active. How much this exactly works out to varies a lot, because it depends on how many temporary values do we need to actually do the computation. Which depends on exactly what you're doing, how many values is the compiler keeping cached that you might not be explicitly specifying. So the compiler might, for example, add something to keep track of a pointer value rather than adding an index to a pointer every iteration. And that would be another register it's usefully using, even though you may have not written that in your code. So there's not a hard rule, but you definitely don't want to exceed the number of actual registers of the type of value you're storing. And usually you want to be definitely more than a few less than that, because you have some overhead. But usually the way you actually tell what works is by seeing whether the compiler, either seeing whether your performance dips, or by looking at the assembly and seeing, do you see code like this? And if you see code like this, in an important part of your program, that probably means the compiler spilling when you don't want it to. It's not necessarily bad for it to spill, like if this is like an outer loop and something with like triply nested loops, because that's not frequently executed, and you don't really care if that happens. But if this is in the important part of the code, that's a problem.
When does performance begin to dip on a couple of slides?
So it starts to dip at 8, even, which I suspect that this might just be normal, the overhead we talked about of doing the ads at the end and things like that, or other bookkeeping overhead. But here, it's definitely just spilling. And you notice there's a huge difference in the number of instructions we're running, which is because we took something which was one instruction before and turned it into two. Was the one instruction like this before, where we just add something based on RDX to a register. Okay. So another question you might have about this performance picture I showed you is, where did this 0.57 come from? That seems like an awfully strange number. What is 0.57? So, and we determined that, I told you, my desktop can do 4 ads per cycle, and we need to do an add to compute the address of each element, and an add to actually add it to the sum. So it seems like we should be getting 0.5. So why aren't we getting 0.5? 0.5 would mean that we're doing 4 ads per cycle, 2 for each element, so 0.5. So where's the extra overhead coming from? That doesn't seem to go away. Yeah?
Is that the register delay I mentioned earlier? Like, not everything in real time?
So is that your question? Is this like the delay for like forwarding values between ads and things like that? So that might be a concern. But if that was a concern, we'd expect it to go away with more accumulators, because that would be a way of hiding that. And it doesn't. But yeah, that is something which could affect this, that sort of if we had extra sources of latency, but adding accumulators should hide that by giving us more parallelism. Yeah?
Does it take time to determine whether it needs to use the other accumulators or not? Because like if you're only adding two values, you wouldn't need to use them, and so there's some sort of lock somewhere, right?
This is something that we're implementing by writing code, by writing our assembly this way. So it's the same decision it's making before as far as where it puts values. Yeah?
Is it maybe the end where you have to sum up all of the sort of individual accumulators?
So you're saying, okay, maybe this is the time it takes to sum up the things at the end. So let's try to estimate how much time that is. So we have, in this case, four accumulators. So that means we need to do three adds at the end. And we have 992 elements. So three adds out of extra adds for 992 elements should be like 0.3% extra. So that is part of it, but it doesn't explain how big the difference is. And if this number was much lower, it would definitely be a large part of it. So what else is in the loop? I've shown some of it here. So this is the instruction which does our address computation and add. Address computation and add, address computation and add. And this is part of the address computation. What's this? There's also some other loop instructions I'm not showing. But we need to do other things in the loop, like compare. So what is a compare? Subtraction, which is going to use one of the ALUs that does, because it's basically an add. So we have a few extra operations. And in particular, when I looked at the assembly that it generated for the four-way for the unrolled loops, where it was getting this 0.57 performance, yeah, we had two additions per element, one for the sum, one to compute the address. We also had some other operations. So we had, it turned out, an addition, a subtraction, and a compare to keep track of the loop indices. You might say, why do we need an addition and a subtraction? Why do we need to do that? I don't know. The compiler didn't generate quite the best possible code. But we need a compare, and we also need a branch. And a branch involves computing the address of where the branch goes to, which turns out to need an addition on the way the x86 machine code encoding works. So we have these basically four extra operations for every, four extra adds for every instance of our 16-element loop. And if we just add up two operations for every element plus 2 out of 16 four out of 16 for these extra loop overhead operations that require us to do something like an addition, that use one of the adders on the machine, we end up with 0.57. So this tells us that, first of all, this explains where that 0.57 comes from. It's exactly the time we need to do the loop maintenance operations with the 16x unrolled loop, which is something we might get rid of by unrolling our loop more. And it also tells us that we're getting the maximum throughput we could possibly get with this. Because we're, at least for the adders, we're using all the adders all the time, it looks like. So we can't possibly do any better. So any questions about this figuring here? So that's our sort of maximum performance. So with adds, so let's think about changing this. We can do the same technique. It doesn't actually have to be sums. We can do it with other sorts of calculations that are redundant. Let's look at changing it to a multiply. So I just took the code I had, replaced the additions with multiplications. And this is the performance I get. So something is different here. So my machine has a maximum throughput of 1 multiply per second. And I need at least more than 2 accumulators to actually get that. So why is that? Why can't I do it with 1 if I can do a multiply per cycle? What could be happening? And part of the thing to remember is that the reason for this is one of those things which is not true about the processor you implemented, but does happen in real processors, about how multiplies are implemented on my processor. Yeah.
Maybe you have a data hazard.
Okay, so the right way, so you're thinking there's probably some sort of data hazard that keeps us from doing a multiply every time. So with 1 accumulator, where could that data hazard come from? So we're doing sum times equals A of I. So what are our possible, what's the data hazard?
Like the memory load.
So we could be waiting for the memory load, but if we were doing that, we would expect the add to be slower. Because we can compute all the memory loads in the same time. But that would be a possibility if, you know, if you didn't know that the adds didn't have this problem. But there is a data hazard is the right way of thinking about it. So there's something keeping us from starting the multiply instruction. And it's because we don't have some data. So why don't we have the data? What could be happening? And there's a hint on the slide. So on my machine, I looked up in Intel's manual. And it tells me in that manual, 1 cycle for every multiply. That's the maximum throughput you can get. It also tells me the latency of each of those multiplies is 3 cycles. So just like our add, we could do 4 per cycle, but the latency was 1. With multiply, we can do 1 per cycle, but the latency is 3. So we still need, to get our maximum performance, we still need this sort of multiple things in parallel, because we can start a multiply in 1 cycle, get the answer 3 cycles later, and if we don't start a multiply in the next cycle that doesn't depend on that answer, we're wasting our multiply units. We have a pipeline multiplier in this processor, and it's common to have pipeline implementations of complex arithmetic operations. And we're just waiting around for the answer rather than giving the pipeline a new thing to do. Because we have, as you said, a data hazard. The data hazard is we're waiting for the multiplicand from the prior thing, prior multiply operation. And given the given that we have each takes 3 cycles, that means we need to have 3 happening all the time to get the maximum throughput. And that makes sense. In order to do that, we need 3 accumulators. We need to have 3 paths running in parallel to get it, and that's why we didn't get this maximum performance with 2 accumulators, but we did get it with 4. So any questions about this setup here? What changed between our add and our multiply? Yeah.
So if we have 3 accumulators, would it be similar if we have 4?
I would hypothesize that 3 accumulators would be similar to 4, but I didn't actually test it. Yeah.
Can you talk about why so when we go up to 16 accumulators before we were having register fail and it was like drastically worse? It's only marginally worse.
Okay. So the question is, previously when we had lots of register spilling, we had really much worse cycles per element. Now we only have a little bit worse.
Is that because we're bottlenecked by
And your hypothesis is maybe we're bottlenecked by the data dependency. And that would be my best guess, is that it's not the case that we're not spending any less time accessing memory. It's just that the slowest thing going on is the multiplies. So the extra loads and stores can happen while we're waiting for the multiplies to happen. So we just don't notice it because there's not enough extra loads and stores. So we only have a little extra overhead. even though we're writing a lot more instructions. That would be my hypothesis. I can't quite verify that that's exactly what's going on, but yeah, that would be my guess, because it makes sense. Because if you think previously, one way of thinking about it is that, you know, maybe it takes, we can do the loads and stores we need to do for the additions in at a rate of 0.75 per elements worth per cycle, or 0.75 cycles per element worth. And if we can still do that here, we're not going to change our performance, because we're waiting, because the multiply performance is 1. It doesn't matter. We could have, it could take up to 1 cycle per element to load and store the values that we need to compute the sums into. Okay. So some other notes on sort of loop unrolling topics, since we've gone through accumulators. So there's some special cases of loop unrolling, which are interesting. So one is full unrolling. So full unrolling is often very different in how it behaves than partial unrolling, partly because it makes it think really easy for the compiler, because the compiler might do other optimizations, it knows things are constant, so it might be able to do things that are a lot better in the case of full unrolling. So that's a special case, and usually the compiler won't do that for you, unless it's a very small loop that it can tell is like only 2 iterations. Another thing I'd like to note is that loop unrolling has a nice interaction with cache blocking, and that with cache blocking you create these smaller loops that usually have a constant number of iterations because they're your block size, so they're a good candidate for unrolling. Because you don't have to worry about the leftover usually, because you know you're working on a whole block, and you know exactly how many iterations there's going to be in advance. And since we talked about register spilling, so I think we know all that. Okay. So any other questions on sort of our loop optimizations here? Yeah.
In order to actually like fully unroll a loop, you actually need to know how many times it's running, like every time.
The question is, to fully unroll a loop, we need to know exactly how many times it's running. Yes. So if you can't do that, you're not going to fully unroll it, because you need some, unless you're going to have conditionals, which is basically the same. So another sort of loop optimization is about removing redundant operations. So this piece of code, which is based on what our textbook shows, has a big performance problem. So what is it? This code has horrible performance. Yeah?
You're calculating string length multiple times.
Yeah, so we're calculating string length multiple times. So what does the string length function do? Yeah?
Doesn't it just go through the array and add epsilon every time?
Until
it gets to the pointer.
Yeah, so string len takes a pointer, it looks at the thing it points to, is it null? If not, it goes on to the next one and keeps going until it gets to the null. So if our string has a length of n, then we're doing order n operations for each check of the loop condition, so we're doing that n times. So this loop is secretly quadratic. And we mentioned this because this is an error which is surprisingly common. Like, people have release commercial software which accidentally does this sort of thing. And this is the sort of case where it's surprising, because you usually, in some languages, you think of checking the length of something as something which basically just accesses a constant, a variable. Like, if you ask for the length of an array in Java, that's reading a variable that's associated with the array. If you ask for the length of a string in Java, that's usually reading a variable that's associated with it. Maybe not anymore. Used to be. So there's an easy fix to this that you can do, which is put string in an unequal variable. So can our compiler do that? So in this case, yes. But what's going to make it difficult for the compiler to do that? So yeah.
So there's a loop, so they're already going to be using auto registers, like they don't want to waste one.
So the question is, maybe the compiler thinks that we don't have the extra registers for that. I note that it'd still be faster if we put it on the stack. Yeah.
There could be side effects to that code, so like it could change something, or like that function's behavior, so it could change something else elsewhere in the program.
Okay. So maybe, yeah. So one thing is that if the compiler is just seeing this code, it doesn't know what the implementation of string len looks like. And remember we said that compilers usually don't look inside functions. So if the compiler knew what stringlen looked like, it could do this, maybe. But given that it doesn't, given the code it's seeing, it doesn't know what's going to happen. Maybe stringlen changes the string every time. It doesn't know that from this code. We know that because we understand what stringlen's supposed to do, but the compiler wouldn't know that. So other issues? Yeah.
I think this might be very similar to that, but just like stringlen could be, like this, it's within the loop, you could be changing the length of string.
Okay, yeah. So another issue is that, yeah, maybe the loop changes the string. So in this case, it's actually easy to show that it doesn't, but it wouldn't take much for us to do something where it'd be hard to show. One example is that this is a column with aliasing. So if we access anything through a character pointer, then all of a sudden, to prove that we aren't changing the string, the compiler needs to prove that none of those character pointers that we're changing point to the string, which is usually very, very hard and very unlikely to happen. So even if the compiler understands what stringlen does, this still can be a very hard optimization for it to do itself, because it would need to go through whatever code you have in the loop, and that needs to be simple enough for the compiler to figure out, okay, you aren't changing the argument. Not even indirectly through another pointer to something that seems unrelated. So it's very unlikely the compiler can do this itself, but you can do it. And you should watch out for patterns like this. And this is worth mentioning because these are like really easy to fix, and this is a big O improvement. Like, none of the things we've talked about are big O improvements before. They're all constant factors. Often big constant factors, but constant factors. And I note that this pattern happens in some other ways. So here's some code where we're comparing I plus amount to n several times. This technically isn't just a straight up normal redundant thing where you can just pull out a variable. But what can we say about this comparison? So when is that comparison true or not? This is an algebra problem. Yeah.
Well, so we're running the for loop for I from 0 to n.
Yeah.
In any case, we already know that. So as a result, we can probably do some math and like figure out what we should be checking that evolution. It's kind of
excessive. Mm-hmm. So your observation is that we know I goes from 0 to n, so we can figure out how that interacts with I plus amount less than n.
Yeah, so if amount like is already greater than n, then like that will never be true.
Okay, so one thing we know, for example, is that we don't need to do this comparison at all if amount is greater than n or less than or equal to 0. So that's one thing we could do, but the straightforward way of doing that is to add like more comparisons. That's not what we want to do. How do we take advantage of that information?
Can you just break it into two separate pieces, where the first one just goes from 0 to n minus amount, and then the second one goes from n minus amount to n?
Yeah, so something we can do is we can split this up into loops for the case where this is true and the case where that is true. This is not completely trivial, because we need to figure out how do we write a loop for only the cases where this is true and only the cases where this is true. So to do that, we can use algebra and reason, this means I is less than n minus amount. And that splits up the I's evenly. So we can figure that out in this case. And there's, with a more complicated condition, you can sometimes figure out a way to do that, sometimes not. But then you can write a loop like this, and this is going to be a lot better. So one reason it's a lot better is just because we aren't comparing I to amount to n and I to amount, I plus amount to n over and over again. We're just doing one of them. Another reason it's better is that this is going to expose opportunities for us to do other loop optimizations. Because loop unrolling on this is going to work out better, because we've actually gotten rid of conditional jumps all the time, not just only one of them. And and we can maybe do multiple accumulators if there and things that are like this that would give us more opportunity to do that because it's a more regular loop. So just doing this sort of splitting makes this loop more amenable to other optimizations. And this is sort of moving this operation out of the loop. So sometimes called like loop hoisting. We're hoisting the operation above the loop. And sometimes it's not so trivial like this. Other times it's really trivial like the string length case. And the compiler will try to do this itself, but it's not likely to see to do it in cases like this. Maybe it will, but probably not, and certainly not, as we discussed, for string len, where it needs to reason about like whether the value is really constant. And that's hard to figure out. So this is something that may help you to do yourself. Also, usually in cases where it makes sense, it makes the code clearer. Maybe not always, but usually it does. So that's removing dynamic operations. So in another set of miscellaneous optimizations, so moving away from loops, let's talk about constant multiplies and divides. So when we did bit shifting, bit fiddling stuff, we talked about how you could, well, you had to do multiply times 5/8. This is the unsigned version, which is why it's simple. So this is multiplying times 5/8. You can write this sort of shift, and this is a multiply times 5 with a load effective address instruction. And the compiler knows how to do this. So the compiler knows how to do this, but it needs to know that it's times 5 and divided by 8. Otherwise, it's going to generate a multiply and a divide. So having these constants is really helpful for the compiler in some cases. So it can just specialize arithmetic operations to this sort of fast bitwise stuff. You don't have to do it yourself, because the compiler is really good at it, but it's only really good at it if it knows that it's dividing by 8 and not something else. And I'd also note that the compiler can do this for cases where you don't know how to do it. So for example, this is what GCC generates for this code of dividing x by the constant 100. I do not expect you to know how to do this. This is multiplying times the reciprocal, but not in a funny, in modulo something, which is actually something you can do. But I don't expect you to know how to compute this, but you should be aware that the compiler can specialize things like this. And this seems awfully expensive. Like we're doing a shift, a multiply, a shift, a move, and a subtract to implement a division. Is that really worth it? And well, if you look up in the Intel manual what the latency of a 32-bit division is, the answer is something like 60 plus cycles. So yes it is. But of course, if the compiler didn't have a divided by 100, it's not going to do this. Yeah?
What's up with the huge number in the
second line? So the question is, what's this huge number? So that number is the reciprocal of 100 modulo 2 to the 31, I think. Which, if you know the right discrete math, you can figure out that that is or isn't true. Yeah, so this is not a transformation I expect you to know how to do, and like anyone who does it, the only reason they do it is because they're writing a compiler, pretty much. And this optimization does matter, but it's the compiler can just have the code to do it. So just something I want you to be aware of. And there's other cases where the compiler might be able to take advantage of things being constant and simplify the arithmetic operations. This is something compilers are good at. They're good at it because it involves no problems with aliasing, right? You don't have to worry about values in memory. It's all very simple, mechanical, local optimizations where you can just program a rule that looks at a small number of values and figures out how to do something. But they can only do it if it's actually constants that they can figure out how to use. So that's my overview of a bunch of optimization techniques. So any questions about any of the optimization techniques we talked about in the last 2 days? I do have another topic, but like the bookend the techniques. Okay, we'll see if you come up with any later. So let's think about actually applying these. So let's say I'm given a 10,000 line C program that someone thinks is slow, and I need to make it faster. What's the first thing I should do? Just given 10,000 lines of C code, and they tell me, this is way too slow, make it fast. Yeah.
I'd say the thing that we talked about, that we've done in operations.
Okay, so you say the first thing I should look for is redundant operations. Any other ideas? Yeah.
I need to compile it with an optimization flag.
Okay, so make sure I'm compiling with optimization. That's a good first step. Hopefully they already tried that, but maybe not. I should check that it's still fast, still slow after doing that. Yeah?
I forget what it's called, but the thing we just did where we moved functions outside and store them in local variables.
Okay, so I should look to remove things from loops, since that seems to be the most beneficial possible optimization. Any other ideas? So I have this 10,000 line C program. So your proposal is I should go through, look at the loops, look at each loop, and decide to do that?
Maybe figure out what it's actually doing first.
Figure it out what it's actually doing. Can you maybe be more specific?
So run it and see with certain inputs what the outputs would be, and see if there are any heuristics you could use maybe to make it simpler.
Okay, so try to run it and see, figure out what types of inputs make it slow or not, that sort of thing. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, maybe try to find the actual parts of it that are slow or really need improvement and target those in code.
Yeah, so one thing I should probably do is I should look at what parts of it are actually slow. I have this big C program. I could just go to every loop and try to do these optimizations, but most of the time that's probably not the important part. So the most important thing about optimizing real programs is to spend your effort where it actually matters. So if your program spends 90% of its time reading files, you probably shouldn't be optimizing its computation. Maybe its computation is hideously slow compared to what it could be, but you optimize that and you still have a slow program. So this is an important first step, and there are tools to help you do this. They're called profilers. They determine where you spend the time. And I'm going to go through an example, which is a tool on Linux called perf. So perf is what is called PERF, is a sampling profiler. So sampling means that what it's going to do is when I'm running my program, it's going to stop everything periodically and look at what was running. It's going to take a stack trace periodically. And based on that stack trace, it's going to tell me what parts of my code were running most often, and that's going to tell me what parts were slow, at least taking up the most time. So there are other ways you can make profilers. You can make profilers by instead trying to count how many times each thing is run, how many seconds each thing takes. That's another strategy. They have different trade-offs. The advantage of sampling is that usually the measurement error is pretty evenly distributed because you're sampling based on time, not based on function calls. But the other types often have errors because they have a little extra overhead to count a function. But on the other hand, they also tell you how many times each function gets run, which if you're sampling one, you might get unlucky and never see a function that's actually run. Okay. So in order to have a realistic sample here, I have an example of my naive square implementation up here. And I have this in a self-contained program, which has code to read a matrix from a file and write out a matrix to a file. And I have prepared some big matrices. The first line of the file in my input format is the number of elements that are the number of rows and columns. So in this case, this is a 2,000 row and column. And then I have some random numbers, lots and lots of random numbers for a line. Yeah. And I want to profile this program and see where it's spending its time. So I'm going to run the perf command to do this. So there's a subcommand, which is record, to actually take samples. I'm going to say take 10,000 samples per second. I have this option, which says to record not only where you get the sample, but record what the call stack looked like. And there's this equals dwarf option, because it needs to know how to figure out what the call stack looks like. And it's going to use debugging information in my program. And the format of debugging information that GCC uses on my system is called dwarf. So that's where that name comes from. And I'm going to output to some file to have my recordings. And I'm going to run the program with my input file, outputting to an output file. So I'll just run this. It will take a bit of time. And it tells me that it took 182 samples of my program, approximately. That's not an exact number. Wrote 1.4 meg of data of samples. So then I can want to look at those results. So it's not a file that I can just open in the text editor. So the perf has another subcommand to look at it. Two others we'll look at today. So the biggest one is report. And I'm going to tell run perf report on matrix times PM. Okay. And this gives me this picture. So I'll try to explain the columns here. So we have a column called command. So the command column tells me what program is running. So this is a profiler that can profile the entire system. So it can profile multiple commands. And it tells you which command, when it took its sample, what command was running at the time. It also has shared object. So shared object means what executable was the code that was running in. What file that is. So sometimes it was in my executable file square example. Sometimes it's in the C library. It also has the symbol. That's the name of the thing in the assembly that corresponded to this, the code that I was executing. So in some cases, it's square, that function I was running. In some cases, it's underscore start, which is a function the compiler adds to start my program. And a whole bunch of other names. I know there's some special cases here. So this shared object here, kernel.kolsems, and this k here, this actually means that this is something in the OS. So while my program was running, the OS did something that took some time. And this tool tells me that. So all this time here is not my fault. The OS was actually doing something that took a bunch of time. And then we have these other columns here. So we have the children column. So the children column is the amount of samples that were in this function or in a function that this function called that we could tell from the stack trace we have. So it doesn't get a full stack trace, so this is not going to be precise. It only gets a certain number of stack elements. So it might be missing some inclusive cases. That's why, for example, main doesn't contain everything, because it doesn't get enough of a stack trace to tell all the time. And then there's the self column, which is how many times when we stopped in this function, when we got a sample that contained this function, was this function at the top of the stack. This is the thing currently running, not something it was calling or that interrupted it, like the OS running in the middle of my square function. So one thing that's notable here is that we have all this time spent in string to MPN ISRA, whatever that is. And I'm surprised that this diagnosed this program. But that's the problem of doing live demos. So this is called by read matrix. So we're spending about 23% of our time reading the input file, parsing the input file. And I can tell this because this breakdown tells me sometimes it didn't figure out where it was called for some reason. Doing call stacks and optimized code is hard. But it was called by, this is a function called by read matrix that is slow. So it looks like we're spending a lot of our time reading this code. And yes, problem with doing live demos is that this tool, it works better with something that runs longer. So it didn't work out so well. So we see here that, you know, that we have a lot of overhead for reading the file, which is going to limit what we can benefit by optimizing square. But based on this, we're spending a reasonable amount of our time squaring. We probably, because the OS spent so much time while we were running, we probably would want to run this again so that doesn't happen, because clearly that probably messed things up a bunch. Right? It probably makes our results aren't very good. Okay. So, since this is messed up, I will use a different example. So this is my prepared example, which doesn't have that problem. Doesn't have the problem with the OS taking up a massive amount of time in the middle, or as massive amount of time. It still takes up a massive amount of time in the middle. But this is more representative of what the program does. And this is what it does with a larger input. So here, this is with a larger input file. So our squaring takes up more of the time relative to our read and our overhead of reading and such. But reading is still that this operation, which is part of reading the matrix, is still a lot of our time. Still like 20%. Even though this time at least we're spending 70% of our time actually doing real work. And you can see that we spend 6% of our time writing it, for example, in this case. So this is helpful when you have a big program, especially one that runs for longer, so you have more samples, so you have less errors from like the OS running for a little bit of time than I did in this case. I just wanted an example that would fit in the class time comfortably. This is how you should start with actually doing something. So you should run something which runs for longer than my example, so you'll get a cleaner division of work. You run more iterations or something like that. You get a better sample, but you didn't want to sit here waiting for 2 minutes for something to run. And this will tell you what functions in my program are important. And the tricky thing about reading this is you have to take into account the children thing. So because main is up here doesn't mean that I should optimize main. Main calls things that take up time. We're not actually spending much time in main. We're spending 0% of our samples are in main. But we're spending a lot of time stuff main calls, which makes sense. Doesn't mean you should optimize main. Read matrix is the same thing, but you know, there you can think of more of maybe I could call something more efficient or something like that. Okay. So another thing that perf supports as a way of looking at the outputs of its profiling are it has something which gives you a much more detailed view. So there's a subcommand annotate. Which will show you where will show you the assembly view annotated by where it found samples. So this is telling me that in this profile run, 83% of my samples stopped on this instruction, this BFM add, whatever that is. And a lot of things stop in this loop around it. So this tells me this is the loop, this piece of assembly, this is the thing I should care about speeding up. Doesn't mean I shouldn't necessarily unroll it or anything, because that might not be the way to speed it up. And it tells me this is where I'm spending my time. These particular instructions. And not, for example, the one down here. Whatever that does, we didn't stop in the middle of it very often, so it's probably not nearly as important to our performance. Yeah.
does the stopping have to happen periodically? So like, could that be the reason why that specifically is like the place that it affects stopping?
So the question is, does the stopping happen periodically? Yes. The way this profile works is it uses a fixed rate. I chose 10,000 times a second, which is higher than they usually recommend, but just so I could run it for a short time. So yes, so the periodicness can have some problems. So one of the problems is that maybe our program is synced up with the clock, in which case we'll have a problem. And it would be better if they sampled with a different distribution, but I don't know of any profiler which does that. The other issue is that stopping the program is not actually that straightforward a thing. So it's using, if you remember, the precise exceptions mechanism. That's basically how it's going to stop. But the processor, you know, if it's running, say, this vmove instruction and this add instruction and this comp instruction and this JB instruction, and we tell it to stop, it might be the case that it always stops in the JB. Doesn't mean that these other instructions, this comp and this add, where we have no samples, aren't important. Just that when we try set to stop, the processor never managed to stop exactly there. It needed to go a little bit further before it could find a point where it could return to the OS to tell the profiler what was happening. So, but this is like if when you actually want to know what's going on in your program, especially if you have more samples where, you know, if you run this for something that takes minutes, you'll get some scattering of stuff around this or in the other parts of the code that run a non-trivial amount of the time. And it will give you a good idea like what instructions are probably important, with the caveat that this is what happens when we say, stop right now, and the processor stops at the next convenient point. It's not actually like a count of how many times each instruction is run. So any questions about this? So that's profilers. So there are also profilers which don't do sampling, as I mentioned. So these have trade-offs, like they'll actually like tell you how much each instruction is run and things like that. On the other hand, they'll be less representative of how much time is spent where, because there's more overhead to like on each function rather than the overhead being evenly distributed over time, at least approximately. And that, yeah, wow, that was great. Why is the Q button next to the tap button? So any questions about profiling in general? Move on. Yeah.
So I assume there are also memory profilers too, because this seems more specific to like CPU and like CPU cycles and stuff. So
you're like you're asking the question is, are there memory profilers? So what is called a memory profiler is probably not what you're thinking of. Are you looking for something that tells you about cache usage?
Cache usage or like RAM usage, like accesses to memory.
Okay, so the question is, are there profilers focused on access to memory? So this is focused on time, not CPU usage. So if you have something which is slow because it's accessing memory all the time, it will find that. It will say it's slow. So that could have been the reason that loop was slow, because each of those instructions was a memory access. But there are profilers that are specifically focused on telling you about cache misses. So one thing is that perf has an option where you can say, instead of take, you can ask it to, instead of taking samples every amount of time, you can say, take a sample every like millionth cache miss. And that will tell you where your cache misses are. Using that information is not as trivial as just sort of the general, where's the hotspot information. But yes, there are ones for that. There's also some tools which do cache simulation. So which will run your program simulating the cache and will tell you like for every instruction with that simulated cache, how many misses were there? Which could be useful. It's not as straightforward to use, it's just the time information. Given that what you're going to do is you're going to optimize it, and you need to figure out what's the bottleneck exactly anyways. And we know because we can overlap like adds with accessing memory, that just because you have a cache miss doesn't mean that's the reason it's slow. So speaking of, we'll skip that actually. So let's talk a bit about another feature of processors. We'll go back to prefetching if we have time. So modern processors have some features called vector registers. They have registers that can hold multiple values, a vector of values. So for example, 64-bit x86 has 128-bit registers named XMM0 through XMM115. That can hold 128 bits, either 4 ints, 4 floats, 2 doubles, various other combinations. And there are instructions which act on all the values in the register at once. And that's obviously nicer than having one instruction that acts on 264 or 232-bit values. So for example, PADD is an instruction which, supposing we have 128 bits, which we're considering as 4 integers, say 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, 6, 7, 8, it will add them together pairwise. So add 1 and 5 to get 6, 2 and 6 to get 8, and so on. And this is faster to use than adding them separately, for partly because the processors have an ALU which actually does this. Like it actually does 4 adds at a time. And partly because it's less instructions. So there's less overhead from the instruction dispatch. And sometimes compilers will figure out how to use it. So if I give the compiler like the best possible case, my current version of GCC can figure out how to do this at certain optimization levels. It's not consistent. It's tricky to use these because you have to have things lined exactly up for the add instruction. You have to worry about what if there's leftovers, what if it's not a multiple of 4 or whatever, however many of the things you can fit in. If they're not like this case where they're exactly lined up into arrays in the same positions, then you have to do extra work. So it's not actually straightforward for the compiler or humans to do this transformation to use these instructions. So the compiler sometimes figures it out, often it doesn't. But it is faster when it works. Also, you may remember on some prior graphs, we had these funny zigzags, and this was the cause. So at the bottom of the zigzag, things were a multiple of 8, which happened to be how many of the things I could fit in my vector registers. And that pace worked out better. When they weren't, we had this leftover stuff, which took up extra time per element. That was what was happening there. That wasn't a measurement error or something from loop unrolling exactly, that was from these vector register problem issues. So modern compilers do manage to do vector instructions sometimes, but because it's easy to implement on the processor side, but for compilers, it varies. Right. So it's a common feature, but it's hard for compilers to use. Often people do it by hand. But it's a very big optimization when it works, because often it's the only way of getting the maximum performance out of a processor these days. Okay. And in our last minutes, some notes on prefetching. So caches do this thing called prefetching, which is that they look for periodic patterns, and they try to fetch things that they think they'll use. So usually you don't have to worry about this, but it matters because this is going to be happening under the hood if you have a periodic pattern. And you can actually give explicit hints, but usually they're not helpful, because usually you have a periodic pattern, and that's good enough. And adding the hints might make things slower. Okay, so that's what I have for today.